Good morning, everyone. We welcome you to our Saturday morning Bible study. Today is January 18th, 2020. We are recording from the Plainfield Christian Science Church Independent, Plainfield, New Jersey, the United States of America, and we're so glad you could all join us today. The moderator today is Mike from New York.
Thank you. We shall start with a quote. And this again is from the rebuilding by Nehemiah of the Wall of Jerusalem from the Christian Science Journal, September 1889, by Annie F. Colt, C.S. And here's the quote. In all this, there is a lesson for us Christian scientists to heed. We have been in a bondage worse than that of the Jews to the Persian king. Walls of our Jerusalem, spiritual sense, have been in ruins, and we exposed to the attacks of our enemies, the lusts of the flesh. The founder of Christian Science has brought to us the perfect truth and has called on us to rebuild our walls. Work of rebuilding or regeneration must first be done in ourselves. Then comes the rebuilding of the walls for all, preaching of the blessed gospel of truth to every creature. While we rebuild our own walls through truth, our enemies are partly willing to let the work go on as soon as we wish to branch out and rebuild the wall of truth about all their homes. Then the people wish us to come down from the wall onto their level. But can we afford to do this any more than Nehemiah could? Can we afford to mingle with people on the plane of mortal mind instead of keeping our place upon the solid foundations of the wall of truth? They wish to make a treaty with us, let them come up to our plane, but we cannot, must not, go back down to theirs.
Very good, thank you.
Good counsel, thank you.
Okay, any comments on that?
I thought it was really good that I think it was Annie F. Colt that wrote that, that she brought it into, that it wasn't just back in Nehemiah's day that this kind of thing was going on, and that it's a continual rebuilding of the wall, that we need to regenerate ourselves and beware of the, and we protect our spiritual sense and have our watch, keep our watches and our defenses up.
Very true. Thank you.
I think when I was looking at this, I was thinking, and some of the thoughts that came was this rebuilding and to take it individually, I was thinking, now that I know who I really am, what God is saying that I am, it's like keeping it up, keeping the boundaries watched so that nothing can come in. And the thought was funny. It's like the science of the mortal sense to tell me, oh, you're not this or you're not that. So to me, it's very practical. It's very something, you know, to use for ourselves. Not to refuse always to let anything tell us what is not.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's all part of the battle that mortal mind tries to wage against the truth, isn't it? As we perceive the truth clearly, mortal beliefs feel threatened. And then they do their best to try to get you to come down off of your truth. And when you try to spread the truth to others, then it really gets threatened. Because then you threaten their institutions, you threaten their livelihood, you threaten everything that they count on and depend upon, all of which they should not be counting on and depending upon in the first place if they knew better. But they don't.
And this is what is known as taking up the cross.
I was also thinking about how this is such an important activity of the Christian Science movement, if you want, and that I never had any instruction, or it was never mentioned or in my previous church experience. And I'm just dumbfounded at to the importance Mrs. Eddy put on it. She wrote so much about it, and yet for years it's just incredible to me. And so it explains a lot about what's going on in the, you know, why churches are closing, why more people. And I just heard from my daughter, who talked to to her dad about that more, at least in the branch, the church that he's going to, he's not a member, but there are more people going to doctors, and it's just no big deal anymore. I thought, wow, and that's a result of this watching was just never, so now it explains a lot about what, so I'm just so grateful that I've found Plainfield and realize now that this watching is so important, and I can't imagine not doing it. It's just, I have a lot to learn about how better to do it all the time, but at least I'm doing it. We're doing it. And that's the only thing that's going to save mankind.
Thank you very much.
And that's a great safety for you to now feel the danger and recognize what needs to be done. That's a very, very important first step. A lot of people don't get there to that first step. They think, well, things are fine. I'll just kind of cruise along. What do I need to watch for? Animal magnetism is nothing, so I can ignore it. Mrs. Eddy saw this. She saw the ways of mortal mind, immortal beliefs. She saw how wicked and how cunning and how subtle they tried to entice people. And she saw the danger to the church if the church did not obey the manual. And they ended up not obeying the manual, and they ended up suffering the demise that she foresaw.
I'm going to read, this is going to be in our next Liberator. The theme of our next Liberator is the manual. And this article is by Andrew Hartsook. I'm not sure if it's in his book or if it was just something he wrote. But anyway, he said, some of the consequences of the 1910 director's circumventing of Mrs. Eddy's design of her church manual have not been widely considered. The centralization of power and authority has resulted not only in damage by well-meaning scientists, but has also perhaps enabled hostile elements to infiltrate the headquarters and thereby damage the movement, which would have been almost impossible to do in the decentralized movement which Mrs. Eddy intended. For example, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union targeted the Boston headquarters for infiltration in the Manual of Instructions of Psychopolitical Warfare, published in the early 1930s, for use by the communist operatives. In one of the chapters, The Smashing of Religious Groups, the following appears, quote, in the field of pure healing, the Church of Christ Scientists of Boston, Massachusetts, excels in commanding the public favor and operates many sanatoriums. All must be swept aside. They must be ridiculed and defamed, and every cure they advertise must be asserted as a hoax. You must recruit every agency of the nation marked for slaughter into a foaming hatred of religious healing. You must suborn district attorneys and judges into an intense belief as fervent as ancient faith in God, that Christian Science or any other religious practice which might devote itself to mental healing is vicious, bad, insanity-causing, publicly hated, and intolerable. We must be like the vine upon the tree. We use the tree to climb and then strangling it, grow into power on the nourishment of its flesh.
End quote.
We've read this a few weeks ago, but it's worth repeating. And then he goes on, but the purpose of reproducing these poisonous thoughts is to alert the reader and also to suggest a lesson. We should all resolve to be much more watchful in handling such aggressive designs, but we should also consider that such infiltration could not be done in a decentralized Christian Science movement, while a centralized organization is an alluring target. What is that expression? One fire you can put out, but you know, when you've got, all these churches all over, it'd be very hard. And so we have come up out of the ashes as an independent church. We have been greatly blessed to be getting all the literature needed to understand what watching is and everything else that we should have been doing from many years ago, and which were suppressed by the organization. And now we're getting the word out, is giving it free course, so it is going all over the world, and they will not be able to stop it. It will be impossible. The other thing I think fits in here, because this was appalling to me, and that is Linda sent me a cover of, it was the Principia magazine, and what was on the cover, Linda, tell them.
It was a student who had gone to the school, and he's, I guess, a writer or producer of, cannot remember the name of the...
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, thank you, which is a very wicked show if you break down what its contents and purpose is, and it's very alluring, and it played on HBO on Sundays. And the cover was very dark. And actually, when I came home and saw it on my table, in the mail, I was startled at it. And I thought, I didn't know if my sons had brought something in or what it was, because it looked very witchcrafty to me in some of the wording they used, I guess, what you would call the time period that movie would have come from, the gothic kind of look. It was gothic. And I was going to go ask them what they brought in when I realized that was the publication from Principia, but it was concerning to me.
I was appalled by this. This Game of Thrones, it's like 50 Shades of Grey, where everybody was watching it. Everyone was talking about it. So one time I got this free HBO thing and I watched, I think it was the first episode. It is wizardry, witchcraft, and pornography. All right, that's what this was about. And I think it continues through the series. I mean, Gary walked through the living room while I was watching and said, Mary, what the heck? I mean, and to think that a Principia, to think that a Principia graduate and the idea is they're proud of it, I'm telling you, I am on fire over this. And this is why, and I'm not holding back anymore, this is why years ago when I thought I wanted to go to Principia, Mrs. Evans refused to sign my application. She knew then. And so, why is this on the cover of their magazine? They're proud of it? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Not only is it on the cover, but it's all in red and black, and it makes it look, you know, as demonic as possible. My previous job was art director. People would come and say, oh, I want it to be, you know, a certain way. And then I had to decide, like, what colors and everything made it look like that. So they weren't looking for anything nice to make that.
It was demonic. That's the only word for it. And the reason I watched it at all was because I'm interested in what everyone's watching and what they're taking in. Well, I found out, and it wasn't good. I've never read 50 Shades of Grey, but I read reviews, and I've heard other people tell me what it's about or reviews about it. again, it's sordid. To think that this is being put in the minds of everyone, and then to say it's the producer is from Prynne.
And we're proud of him.
And we're proud of it.
And Linda said that she's never paid for this magazine. It just keeps coming for free. So this is what they give for free to the world, not the real good stuff.
So
I think all of these things, they start, oh, it's okay, and before you know it, it's what people want. So
yes.
Nothing wrong is okay, really.
This is the infiltration of thought. Little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit you get lured in, you know, my gosh, you watch one episode, what's going to happen next, and all of this. And also you get desensitized to all of this.
You'd have to be pretty desensitized to send that magazine out, because as a Christian, I would have been ashamed to have that represent my Christian school.
Yes, absolutely. What were they thinking?
Well, it's not a Christian school.
It isn't.
Period.
And it's certainly not a Christian Science school. And
I just found out that you don't have to be a Christian Scientist to go anymore.
Because they don't have enough.
They don't have enrollment. Enough called Christian Scientists to enroll. Exactly.
Thomas set me up. Thomas in New York, because he went there, and he's kept me
what
up.
What did I?
I know there are others of you that.
I think I did south.
And I thought I wanted to, but when I got down to it, I got a big fat no, not to. And as did Gary, as did others. But you know, those of you who did,
my grandmother wanted me to. when I was interviewed by the representative from the school, he made a point of telling me that they required pictures on the applications and they only selected women who were attractive looking. And he thought that that would make me feel better about going. And I thought,
that is just unbelievable.
You can't make these things up.
Well, you know, this is exactly what I've said, because when I was lobbying, I mean, as a farmer, the congressmen, most of them certainly did not hire people based upon what they knew. I mean, they had these people in mini skirts and barely wearing a blouse, who was the farm, you know, and farm advisor, and she didn't even know what the farm was.
But the reason this applies to Nehemiah is this is the attack. This is how it tries to attack. And you have to be really know who and what you are to not succumb to the attack. And so it is relevant. And all of this is infiltrating. It has thoroughly infiltrated the organization. And this is where we do our watch. We make sure it's not infiltrating anything that we have anything to do with.
And speaking of that infiltration, I mean, that infiltration started 2,000 years ago, even more, but especially then, because Jesus' teachings were definitely not what all Christianity follows. Now, it isn't just Christian Science. I mean, in the 100 years or whatever plus from Mary Baker Eddy, it certainly has gone downhill, but I mean, she had to reinstate it in the true fashion, because it had already been corrupted for so long from what Jesus taught.
It's interesting, too, thank you, Mike, that, you know, in this article was written in 1889. Mrs. Eddy was here. And this Annie Colt is saying, we have been in bondage worse than that of the Jews to the Persian king. So what did she mean by that?
Well, that struck me as very, very fascinating. And this is why Ezra, the book of Ezra, was added to the reading list, because what's fascinating is there were, I think it was Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, if I pronounce that halfway right, were the three kings of Persia, and one of them sent Jews back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple there. And I don't know if Mrs. Roberts wants to speak on it more, but she was telling me that, I didn't realize this, but that the Persians actually believed in one God.
Is the Zoroastrianism that was there during the 6th century, so way, way back then, there was this, Zoroastrians have believed in the supremacy of one God above all. Ahura Mazda, I think that's what they called it, as the maker of all, and the first being before all others. So that was interesting. Yeah. That they believe maybe that's why Xerxes, you know, saw what the Jews believed and sent Ezra to go and teach them people about this one God.
And what's even more amazing is that because the Persians had taken over the Babylonian kingdom and the king returned all of the plunder. Well, I mean, it was all the things that the Babylonians had stolen out of the temple mm-hmm. in Jerusalem. He returned it to the Jews.
Thank you. Well, and one thing I feel I should correct myself when I say our nation is based on Christian principles, Christianity, but also Judea principles. And I correct myself on that because
they're similar.
And all of this history.
And spiritually, they're identical.
Yes.
Yes.
It's one God. And all these prophets we're reading about, they were Jews, weren't they? And Jesus was a Jew. So it's based on the Ten Commandments. It stems way back, way back. And it goes along with what Mrs. Eddy says about the Christ.
But what Annie Colt is talking about here in 1889 is the Comforter, which is a better understanding of who and what this one God is a threat to the medical profession. It's a threat to all the other organized churches that considered themselves so-called Christian churches, academia, and they all fought the coming of the Comforter. They all fought Mrs. Eddy's rebuilding of the wall.
There was also a lot of spiritualism, mesmerism, animal magnetism going on during the time of Mrs. Eddy, as we know, since she addressed it. But there was a big movement in these things.
Yes, absolutely.
In her time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you read any biographies of that time, it's very often people were involved in spiritualism and mesmerism, other things, yes. Thank you.
But now, the reason that people turn to those things is because Christianity had been so, or Judaism / Christianity, the true form of both of them, had been so watered down that they got no comfort from them. They didn't get comfort from the government of the United States even. So they turned to these other things just with, you know, grasping at straws, I guess one might say.
Yes. And she says here, the walls of our Jerusalem, spiritual sense, have been in ruins.
I was reading that and I was really impressed because I thought it also went back to this centralized control that came on. Just imagine what would happen if everything was decentralized. Whatever activity would either stand or fall based on its merits or demerits. But instead, it's propped up by this centralized control manipulation. And we had all these descriptions of things coming out of Principia. I mean, I got to believe that nothing like that would have even been possible if it were allowed to either fall or stand on its merits at the very beginning and wasn't propped up by centralized control.
And that is always the case. And that is the danger. And I'm going to speak more freely about some of these things. That is the danger of socialism, which is a buildup of big government, which is easily corrupted. Our individual rights in anything, wherever we look, that's what we defend, that's what we look for. And we have some very stirring quotes, one from Mrs. Eddy talking about the evil of socialism, and one that Jeremy found from Bicknell Young. So we stay awake and alert, and only the only way you can do this is by knowing the truth, the truths of the Bible. So you cannot be attacked, mesmerized, or have a misconception of what Christianity is by thinking it's do-goody, nice. I shocked someone the other day by saying we were taught here that nice is a four-letter word. He never heard of such a thing. But then, I wish I brought it, but then I read the exact same, it was a quote somewhere about moral courage, and that you can't have moral courage and be nice. They don't go together.
Lauren Sargent says a good person, and then she says there's no safety in that.
There is no safety.
And that's why Jesus rebuked the guy that called him good master. He says, come on, there is none good but one, and that's God. So get off of this human goodies stuff.
If it's okay, I'd like to get into the questions, because actually a lot of that is covered in how Nehemiah overcame the opposition.
Most definitely,
okay,
yes.
Okay, let's do this, yes.
All right, so topic is Nehemiah and God's Governance, Part 2. Bible readings was Nehemiah, the whole chapter, Ezra, the whole chapter. Okay, the question was, who opposes Nehemiah in the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem? And I think we covered the first one in Nehemiah 2, where Sanballat and Tobiah were scorning and making fun and ridiculing and such stuff. And so does anybody want to present the next one? Or?
Well, let's just go into that a little more, because I think we can cover all the points in the questions as we go step by step. So they were being scorned and mocked and laughed at, and saying, you're going to rebel against the king?
Accuse him of treason.
Now, and remember, in that beginning paragraph, it says, first we handle this individually, and then as we handle it more universally, that's when the attack gets even worse. So how do we apply this to ourselves, handling it individually? How does it come to you?
Well, I think in Nehemiah 2:12, when Nehemiah went and even looked at the wall, he went quietly. He didn't say anything to anybody about what his mission was there, because God had put into my heart, God had put into my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me save the beast that I rode on. So there were no men and no beast, unquote. So in other words, he kept it within himself to start with.
Good. That's good, because that can be wisdom. If you speak too soon and get an attack, and who will the attack come from? Well, first, it's an inward attack. It'll tell you, oh, this is stupid. You don't want to do this. These people are too intense. You're going to lose your individuality. You can combine Christian Science with a lot of other things.
Or it'll come to you and say, this is just too much work. I prefer an easier life.
That's the attack. Bruce, what were you going to say?
I was going to say it'll come by saying it's going to make you look ridiculous in the eyes of everybody else that's watching it. So don't even go there.
So those are things that come to you in your head that you have to
deal with.
Yeah, get rid of and replace with what you know to be true. So then, okay, if it can't get to you in your own head, then what does it do?
Your family, friends, because usually it's only one Christian Scientist in family or workplace or anything like that. And it just can be This is why we have to believe in it ourselves. Our own thinking about it, our own confidence in it has to be very strong in order to resist, be able to continue the right way.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mrs. Eddy warns us in the chapter on marriage, doesn't she? She says in every marriage, one person is going to be a little bit higher than the other. And that person has to stand the ground and help the other up, not be dragged down.
Jeremy?
And we had in a lesson recently about restraining untempered zeal. I've been thinking about it a lot. I remember when I first was here, it was, I don't know, I felt like talking about it a lot, but it's usually not a good thing.
No, let God direct your mouth, and don't do it with untempered zeal, yeah, because you'll just be asking for an attack you probably won't be able to handle because you haven't earned your position. So if you know what I mean, you don't have your feet firmly underneath you. You can be easily toppled.
Earn your stripes.
Earn your stripes. So yeah, you'll get it from family members, those you're closest to. And then sometimes, oh, this renegade church, you're going against the mother church, what Mrs. Eddy established. Just as this did, because what did they say? What is this thing that you were doing? Will you rebel against the king?
Treasonous. Unlawful. Mm-hmm.
But when you know the truth and you know our history and you know how they changed the manual, then no one can topple you down. You're unmovable when you know that truth. And so what was Nehemiah's answer to their mocking and their scorn? Bruce? Verse 20, chapter 2.
Well, wasn't it that it was not their attacks on him? Nehemiah prayed that it was an attack against God. And so that was his prayer, save it not from them, but it was their attack. What you're doing is against God. Forget what you're doing to us. It's what you're doing against God that's going to bring to you.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to read that really quick. Then answered I them.
Don't read it quick.
And said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion nor right nor memorial in Jerusalem.
Thank you. He had in his arsenal the answer to the attacks, and so must we. That's why we fill our arsenal every morning, reading and praying and reading the lesson, taking notes. So our arsenal is full. So when the attacks come, you know the answer. The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Frankly, the more I've grown, the more that's how I feel about the organization. Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, God is the lawgiver. And in chapter 4, it describes when these mockery, and evidently it was aggressive mockery. So much so, if you've read this chapter, you find all the descriptions, how they got the people together and armed them, put them on the wall with spears and swords, got them ready, and united them. And even the workers themselves had swords or spears by their side.
Well, and that's because Sanballat and Geshem were trying to organize an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to organize, they were going to infiltrate and kill them all.
So, well, we are ahead of ourselves now. So we got the first one. The first attack was scorning, mockery, making you feel inadequate. First individual, maybe first in your mind, then in other ways. And then the more you expand and realize the attack isn't personal. And remember, these are names. I read where it was called the spirit of Sanballat and Tobiah, the spirit that gets angry when you want to do something for God, and it will mock you from the inside. The same taunting spirit was in Goliath. What did Goliath say to David?
You tiny little chap, what in the heck are you doing?
You little dog.
Yeah, you little dog. Call him a dog.
Who the hell are you?
And he seemed so big and terrifying. But David had his arsenal ready. And in this case, it doesn't take a lot, you know. It doesn't take, because sometimes in the practice, what more should I think of? What more should I do? What more? He had a little pebble and a sling. Just one statement of truth. When taken into your heart and applied, can just whoop, gone.
One thing that I didn't know about the story of David originally was, learning from Frankie Mason and looked it up, and sure enough, there it was that David chose 5 smooth stones out of the stream, which the point was that was the spiritual sense. And as you pointed out, it didn't take all of them, it took one.
One truth known. Faith as small as a mustard seed. So, okay, if we've thoroughly discussed that, we'll go on to the next attack. Methods of opposition. And how it was conquered. What was the next thing they did?
Well, I would say it was the one that Bruce mentioned, where they were organizing a physical attack.
Well, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Create confusion.
We're going to hire a community organizer to come and protest and have a a big protest.
Yeah, and confusion. It tries to get you confused. And I'll hear people say that, I'm confused. How does confusion work?
Makes you start to doubt and lose your focus.
It's challenging what you believe.
Yes.
Yeah, or they
create that you've come to know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or they create a big fight in the middle of the city, and you don't know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Yeah, it makes you think there are either multiple right answers or no right answers.
Thank you. That's good. Mm-hmm. Multiple right answers or no right answers.
I mean, mentioning how all that spiritualism came up when Mrs. Eddy was starting, it's just the same thing. It's just creating confusion.
Thank you.
It stops you from doing the thing that is needed to be done. It's actually induced. It creates a problem and gets you focused on this one thing when there's another thing that needs to be done. It gives you something else to do besides working for God.
Distraction.
Misdirection, like a magician. Look over here.
And that's what Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem wanted to do.
Now, I have to say, I don't know why. So, somehow it was deeply rooted in me that Christian Science was the way. I'm not sure how. I'm maybe my mother who came into it. But and there was a time in my life when I did read some New Age at that time. Found it helpful and turned me only all the more to Christian Science, however. But I don't ever remember being confused as if is this the right way? But I do understand or see where others can be confused because that's not established in them. But I was thinking one of the ways, and we talk about it a lot, to know it's not confusion, is to recognize Mrs. Eddy as what and whom?
The woman in the apocalypse.
Yes.
That's the prophet of today.
That keeps you
biblically prophesied.
That keeps you rooted and grounded and not wondering, well, maybe this other thing is okay. Or, you know, and then there's the Buddhists and there's this, and maybe that was, and maybe this. And Christian Science has no direct claim on everything, because truth is true, and it's, we don't even call it a religion, it's universal truth. It has been expressed throughout the ages, whether you call it Christian Science or not. But it still boils down to Mrs. Eddy and her, and we call it, what kind of revelation is it? A blank revelation?
The final.
Yes, the final revelation.
It is the divine comforter.
Who else teaches you the unreality of error? The unreality of matter? About animal magnetism. Who else delves deep these issues?
With nobody. Such a,
nobody.
I think the unreality of illness, sickness, because if you look, I mean, I have many friends who are so Christian, but all of them still believe illness, sickness is real.
Yes.
And I mean, that to me is what really sets Christian Science totally apart.
It should.
And nobody else teaches that there is this one answer for all people.
Thank you. All people, all nations.
All of God's creation.
All of it. Mm-hmm. No one excluded. No one is, you know, going to hell because of this or that, and the others go to heaven. That's such a refreshing definition. You make your own heaven or hell.
I have a question for you, Mrs. Singletary. So if you had this ironclad belief about Christian Science, but you had never ended up in Plainfield and had spent your life in the Mother Church, would you have learned how to apply that? Because the way I see it is the confusion is not only one can believe strongly in Mrs. Eddy, which I always did, but that didn't mean I could apply Christian Science.
You're absolutely right. And as a young adult, I was totally confused because I was within the movement. I had a practitioner who was in the movement, and I was totally confused and weak and unsure. And it wasn't until I came here and began working with Mrs. Evans that changed. So...
And that's why belief is not sufficient.
Yes, you can't say you're. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one. You know, it's just not adequate to believe in the.
It's being shown how to live it.
And to live it, yeah, exactly.
Go ahead, Florence.
Go ahead, Florence.
No, I feel strongly that it's being shown how to live it, because after so many years in the other church, I just felt like something was missing. I really, in my heart, felt, I didn't know what it was, but I felt like something is missing. And right about that time, thank God, is when my sister and I were introduced to Plainfield. And it was just amazing how Mrs. Evans was teaching this. I mean, now I see why people love when they find our church, how they feel and how they express it, because it's just totally different. How to really, really live it, not read the lesson and then go about your business like I used to do.
Yes, and we did have that example of Mrs. Evans, and she as a child had a wonderful practitioner. She was healed of scarlet fever, of broken bones. There were all these healings that, you know, now you don't hear so much about. And then she went on to heal that way, including raising the dead, someone who had been pronounced dead in the hospital. And the doctors saw it all, and you'd think everyone would convert to Christian Science, but no one converted to Christian Science, even though they saw it. So anyway, she was a healer, and she taught, and we saw how she lived it, but then we got books that also showed how Mrs. Eddy lived it in the Carpenter Works, which again, thank you very much to the organization for telling them we couldn't read them, that they are unauthorized. Thank you so much for that. And then thank you for giving us those books. Who wrote them?
The Peel books.
Yeah, the Peel books. It got me even further confused. Further confused.
I think some of the worst thing was not only not living it, was the deep corruption that you would see and the wickedness that would thrive in it. It wasn't even just people just, you know, you keep hearing about, well, my church is nice or friendly or quiet, but, you know, either they're not seeing the criminal element or it just hasn't hit their church yet. But many of the churches I went in, and the nursing facilities and the camps and I even visited Principia, there was deep corruption going on. Every sin you can imagine, I witnessed or heard about. So that's even worse than not living it.
Yes.
Well, and that's why the greatest blessing for us, Mike, to answer your question, was to be excommunicated by the organization and then sued by the organization. Because that showed us the utter travesty, the utter devastation, the utter wickedness, just the decrepitude of the human mind that had infiltrated the organization in Boston. We would not have believed that there would be so much corruption and wickedness up there had they not excommunicated us and then sued us. And it was the greatest blessing that could have happened to us.
And we prove its nothingness, because it ended up being nothing. It didn't stop us. It
spurred us on, and God prospered us beyond measure.
So if I hadn't had the church, if I hadn't had Mrs. Evans, who knows, I could be still wandering around in the wilderness, which is why I have great compassion for those who still are in the organization. But once they know what's going on, then they have to take the stand and come out and be separate.
Right.
Bruce, you want to read, what was the chapter 4?
Chapter 4, yeah.
Number 9, what did they do to get rid of confusion?
They did this. Verse 9, nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God. That was the first thing that they did. And set a watch against them day and night because of them. Now, that gave me a picture of somebody who had set their heart like a flint towards Jerusalem and wasn't going to be confused by all the noise and distraction.
And that is what Mrs. Eddy did in her household. She had a watch 24 hours a day. And she insisted that Christian Scientists watch. And what do they do in Boston? Do they watch?
No, and again, they suppress the books that teach you how, tell you about it. And, you know, people get upset at me sometimes. Oh, you're talking error. How can you say? Well, who is telling of the foe an ambush? And I haven't personalized this. It's not personal to me. It is an impersonal error that I'm going to shout on the rooftops about, because I don't want others to be as confused and mixed up as I once was. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say, and that's exactly from what I've heard, that Mrs. Evans did in the Plainfield Church, was to pray and then put up a watch.
Absolutely, she did. And as I've told people, she did it before we had the books telling us about the watches. After going up to the organization and meeting with the BOD, whom she thought were the stars and the crown of rejoicing, because she had loved science all her life. She'd had, you know, she loved her church. She loved the people, kind, good people.
She refused to read the unauthorized literature.
Because she had been told not to. She never read a thing because she obeyed whatever they told her. She went up there with a portfolio full of all her healings, and she said she felt like she was looking into the face of evil. And when she came back, she couldn't sleep for days and days and days when she realized what was there. And so she asked us to pray during the night to help her sleep. That's how it started. And then later we found out about the watches.
I think that's what's so beautiful is that, and I see that so much in the story of Nehemiah, which is why I love it so much, is that first thing is you pray, and then it comes to you what to do. And then you find out that's what you were supposed to do. It's really beautiful.
Thank you, Mike. That's a good point.
That's a very good point. And isn't that what Jesus did with his disciples? In the Garden of Gethsemane? He asked them to watch. And what did they do? They slept. Can you imagine what could have happened if they had watched?
And that's what Mrs. Eddy says. It would have changed history. So that is why when you're asked to watch, it's the most solemn thing you could possibly do, holiest, most important. And if you put other things ahead of it, you are being very foolish. You really are. And again, that's the truth. So we watch, and as long as there's a core of good watchers, which we have, we make a pathway, we cut through, we destroy the animal magnetism, we cut through the confusion, we watch. And anyone who wants to watch, you listen, you get online and listen, read. Jeremy's made a whole section of watching, and you definitely get the book, Watches, Prayers, Arguments. Mrs. Eddy, but compiled by Carpenter. Okay, so what was the next? What was the third? I counted four.
Actually, let me really quickly add to what Bruce had there. In 4:14, be not afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and he's on our side, what Nehemiah said. And then also 20, our God shall fight for us.
Yes.
Yeah, the battle is the Lord's. That's so important that we as Christian Scientists remember. The battle is not against people. It's against wrong beliefs. And God does the battle. Truth does the battle. Truth destroys false beliefs. And that's something we can count on all the time, in every situation.
Thank you for pointing those out. Because Nehemiah repeatedly had to reassure and refocus his people, which he did faithfully. And it was quite a good thing.
Thank you. Yes, he did. That's why leadership is sometimes important. Usually someone will rise up. Okay, now what about in chapter 6? What's the next way they tried to trip up Nehemiah?
Is that when Sanballat and Tobiah tempted Nehemiah to meet with them in the village?
On the plain of Ono.
Yep. Come and have a conversation.
So convenient, named Ono.
Oh. Oh no, that's embarrassing.
That was his first warning.
Oh no, good one, Jeremy.
Yeah, they tried 4 times to get him to come down and meet with them.
Thank you, Karen. Very persistent. They don't give up at first. They keep at it. That's why it's called aggressive.
Yeah,
and that's where you have to be careful, because you know, maybe a family member, or in your own thoughts come. And maybe I'll think about this for a while. Yeah, I'm going to think about all this. And you think, and you get more confused. Or a family member, let's talk about this. Aren't you being unreasonable? You really know what you're doing?
Don't you want to hear my side of the story?
Mm-hmm.
Can't you just be the way you used to be?
Yeah, that's a good one. or even on the news. Well, let's you know, this one says that and that one says this, and let's just weigh everything, ponder the whole business. You'll walk away. You won't know, you know what from you know what. It'll be talk about confusion.
One of the saving graces that Nehemiah did was he got the people started on the work, and they were focused and worked quickly. And obviously, these people really, they weren't going to be able to succeed with the brute force like they were challenging to do. So they went to this other method. And here again, it would stop them from obeying and working quickly.
This story and these lessons, this is one of the reasons we're still here today, this church. We imbibe this story. We live this story. And so much more. So, what was the answer? Chapter 6, verse 3.
Why should I come down? I have work to do. Why should I come down and meet with you?
Yep. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? I don't have time for this. And that should always be our answer to Era when it tries to talk to you. I do not have time for this nonsense. And that's true when it's telling you suggestions of financial lack or sickness or other things. Do you have time for this? Do you think you do? Well, you'll just be in a spider's web, and then you think you won't be able to escape it. Why should your work cease to sit and chit-chat with some mortal?
And this will come to us through family members, close friends, who will invite us to go off on a two-week vacation somewhere where you won't be able to do what you do for church, for God.
And they'll show you how lovely the world is and all the amusements in it, and you don't need to work so hard. I mean, that's an example of a way. Or maybe if I talk to him, I'll be able to convince him. A man convinced against his will is what?
Same opinion still.
Yes. This is evident to tell me never engage in a discussion with Gary Singletary. Because he was so smart, he could wrap circles around my head, which is true. unless you really know your stuff, and I'm talking years ago, unless you really know your stuff, and it's not a matter of belief, but deep understanding. And even if it is, it's not good to just have somebody argue and tell you. They can get your head spinning around. Know what you know, and don't move. Okay, so did we cover talking and the oh no plane?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that actually was a very nice thing is I think Nehemiah kind of turned it around, because in 6:9 he says that ask God to strengthen our hands, and so turned it around and used that as an incentive to work even harder, and I didn't get it from, I think from some commentary someplace. Supposedly, it only took them 52 days to repair the whole wall. So they really worked hard and fast.
They worked hard and fast. That's why Mrs. Eddy, you know, when she had the building of the Mother Church, she told them that she gave them a deadline. You don't have time for anything else. You keep focused and keep working. Strengthen your hands. Yes. The prayers in Nehemiah, which we haven't gone over, all of them are amazing. It's well worth study this book. But since we're getting near the end of the session, what is the final way?
They accused Nehemiah that he wanted to be king.
Oh, that was a good one. Yeah, then they'll say you're conceited. Yeah. They'll mock you for that. Who do you think you are? But then also, it's in chapter 6, 10, and 11. First.
Shemaiah.
In 6:10, they asked, somebody came to him and asked him to meet him in the temple because there was a plot against Nehemiah and he would be safe in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This guy Shemaiah wanted to entice him into the temple to protect him from Sanballat and all the others who were out to get him.
Trying to make him look cowardly.
Yeah.
Which, in the face of all the people that were leaning, you know, looking to him, all of a sudden, you know, they wanted, he would look different in the eyes of them. If he looked like a coward, then their trust, those that were trusting in him to lead him, could possibly start turning away from him if he looked the slightest bit afraid.
Yes, it would incite the fear in everybody else, and all of the good that they did would have been undone. And furthermore, this guy was a spy. He probably would have killed Nehemiah if he had enticed him into the temple.
Well, and that's my take on it. They were out to kill him. And we have found that mortal mind, we were taught this, and you remember this very carefully, mortal mind is a killer. It is not your friend. I don't care if it comes to you as human goodness and it seems pleasant and smiling. It's out to kill you.
And that's proven in 6:12 because Nehemiah says, "Lo, I perceived that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced this prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him."
Thank you very much.
So I'm sure that and that's the whole thing is that these people are so base and evil that they're going to use a sanctuary as a place to get them away from everybody to, Gary said, kill them.
But you see, his love and devotion and faithfulness to God was so great, and because all along he'd been watching and praying and keeping a sword in hand.
He couldn't be fooled.
He couldn't be fooled, and they couldn't trick him. Shall such a man as I flee? He wasn't afraid. So they couldn't trick him, try as they might. And you know in the story of Christ Jesus, all the times they tried to trick him, they planted plots and snares to trip him up. But it wasn't human smarts. He had the divine intelligence that always protected and saved. And this was his spiritual sense. And this is what, in the beginning that we read from that Annie Colt, she said this is what had been broken down among Christian scientists, your spiritual sense. So that ultimately what saves and protects, and that's God's voice speaking directly to you. And that is what we must preserve, defend, protect, as in the story of Nehemiah.
It seemed to me also that he wouldn't have only seemed to be cowardly. It would have been a cowardly thing for him to do.
Very good. It would have, yes.
Right.
He was not fooled by all their...
And that's why he didn't like the idea.
Yep. He saw beneath. You know, it's never surface appearances. It's what's underneath the whole thing.
But I still say that it was his knowing from God not to go, because if we had a group of people who really respected their leader, as Nehemiah was, and was told that he was going to be in trouble if he didn't go to the temple to be protected, wouldn't some of the people say, well, yeah, that makes sense, you know, not thinking of him as cowardly, but to preserve this noble person. So I still think that, you know, not that that wouldn't be possibly an issue for some of the people, but I think the big thing here is definitely the spiritual perception that this was a bad deed waiting to happen.
Yeah, and he had done one other thing before this. I know we're running out of time, but he had done one thing before this. A lot of the workers were in debt to the bankers who were other Jews, you know, the leaders of the Jewish community. They were in debt, and they were going to go bankrupt if they continued working. So Nehemiah went to the rulers and the bankers and said, you've got to stop charging interest on all of these loans, or you're going to ruin everything for all of us. And he got them to recognize that they needed to subsidize the building of the wall by supporting the people who were actually doing the work. And that was a big deal. And he got them to agree to it. And that
Thank
was
you it. Very much.
Chapter 5.
Thank you very much for that, because it was more than just them supporting those people. They had literally stolen goods from those poorer people because through high taxes and interest and et cetera, et cetera. So they had rigged the laws to be able to take away first their money, then their land, then their children, even enslaving their children, which is just mind-boggling to me.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is why it was always a rule to tithe, to support the clergy, to support those who are working in the church. In those days, it was the Levites. Today, it's our practitioners.
And the church. So remember, through all this, it's what you live and understand, because your beliefs can be shot down. You've got to be living this and understanding it and applying it every day in your life. And therefore, no man shall make you flee. You'll stand strong in the Lord.
And you'll never be fooled.
And you'll never be fooled by animal magnetism. And it is always animal magnetism. I don't care what face it wears. It's trying to get you to come down and stop the work.
And you can see its nothingness more quickly.
When you see it that way, you can. You will not be fooled. You'll keep your sword and tool in your hands and keep working. Thank you, Mike.
Very much. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you all.
Yes,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you,
everybody.
Thank you, everybody.